Well, hey, cousins, you are listening to Revolutionary Hood Rat with Kim Young, a dope black social worker, and welcome back. I missed y'all last week. I didn't have time to edit an episode and get it posted because I had to be out in the world working and, you know, talking and strategizing and just trying to make this world a better place for black youth and black people. But I'm excited to put this particular episode out into the universe. But before I even kind of tee up the conversation that I have for us all today, I'm gonna tell you right now, I don't have any revolutionary news. There will be no Earth is Ghetto. And I'm gonna do my good black word now. Right, so that you don't have to wait till the end of the episode, because the good black word has much to do with this particular conversation and a lot of the thoughts and feelings that are just emerging across the social work profession as it relates to clinical licensure or just social work licensure and alternative pathways. So let me start by saying my heart is so sad to see the number of social workers, specifically like black and brown social workers, taking on the roles of oppressors, like behaving like oppressors in this particular issue area for our field. It is quite concerning how many social workers are just adamantly opposed to equity in the field of social work. That shit is wild. I'm going to run it back one more time because it makes no goddamn sense. The amount of social workers that are opposed to equity within the profession and field of social work, like what the entire hell is going on? And it just seems like so many have positioned themselves close to just white supremacist structures and capitalistic structures where they believe if they protect the thing that they had to forge war against to gain access to, specifically like a licensure, that then their license doesn't have value or the field becomes devalued. And then it's just like any other kind of profession that we currently have. And it's almost as if many are disconnected from the values and foundations of this work and have bought into this idea that we have to gatekeep. I really question, when has gatekeeping something like social work? I get gatekeeping, you know, recipes to culture. You know, I get that shit all day long. Some things absolutely need to be gatekept. But when I think about the way the word gatekeeping is used in the context of social work licensure, I'm like, that's not gatekeeping, y'all. Y'all are actually performing and behaving as oppressors, like legitimately supporting something that is actively oppressing you and other people that look like you or share commonalities with you. And so much of the good black word is for those who might be teetering on the line around just licensure alternatives or just things that do not require standardized testing. Get curious about how things got like this and recognize like just how bad things are and begin to imagine that they do not have to stay this way. And if we want to position the field of social work up against other fields, like in healthcare, if it's psychiatry, psychology, counseling, nursing, medical, all this type of shit where I just keep hearing the alternative, well, you see other professions do it, we have to do it too. No, the fuck we don't. If anybody don't have to follow the rules the way other people follow the rules, it's got to be the profession of social work. And so I really want us to understand we can take our shit back. And I mean that specifically for black and brown and oppressed folks. Like, this has always been a field where we have belonged. Yet so many structures and systems have been created within the field of social work that have pushed us out of it. But now we're here in it, taking up more space than we've ever taken before. But yet there's a segment of us that are standing on the side of the oppressor, and it is sickening. And I really want as many folks as possible just to wake the hell up. Recognize that you are fighting against your own best interests. And I want better for us, and we deserve better, and we will get better. And so I'm going to walk us into this conversation with Jen and Matt, two phenomenal badass social workers and comrades in this work, specifically around just social work licensure. When I tell you they are both brilliant, they are both brilliant. And I am excited to be able to put this conversation out here for people just to consider a different way of understanding this issue, but also encouraging you to do your own work, do your own research, see the issue from as many sides and perspectives as you need to see it from, but then get on the side of right. And the side of right is having social work licensure alternatives across the entire country and in other localities where other countries and territories where the Association of Social Work Boards is present. I hope you will listen to this conversation and get on the side of right. Let your unlearning begin. All right, Matt, Jen, I'm ready for a conversation. I was so grateful that y'all were willing to jump into this conversation with me and with other folks that will come across this episode, just about the Association of Social Work Boards examinations, but so much more, right? Like all of these conversations that we're hearing in all these different spaces, if it's online, if it's in person, if it's through a text thread, wherever it is, about social work examinations and alternative pathways and all of the, I don't even know why it's controversy. But all the controversy surrounding these particular issues. And when I thought about like, who can I talk to that are experts in their own rights around this to have a balanced conversation, but also an informative one. Because as y'all know, so many people have bad information about exam alternatives and social work examinations. And so y'all both have two brilliant minds around this issue and have a wealth of knowledge. And so I just wanted to be able to invite you here to share that with the other cousins that will tune in. So y'all ready for a good time? Bet. So here's the place that I definitely want to start. I want to start with hearing your stories about like how you even got into this work, like your pathways and journey into social work. So Jen, if you want to kick that off, how did you even end up here?
That is a very long and winding road, actually. I was good at math and science in high school, and I actually started my undergrad degree in engineering. And what? I took like all the core stuff. Yeah, so I've taken like all of the calculus and all the basic physics. And then I was like, there's no heart in this, but I couldn't switch to psychology and graduate on time. So I ended up getting a human factors and ergonomics degree and then wandered for a few years, taking odd jobs, working at family businesses, ended up doing 2 years of AmeriCorps Vista, one in alternative education and one in libraries, doing outreach around digital divide issues. And along all of that, I kept meeting social workers, doing all sorts of things. And I was like, that's really versatile and it has heart. Like that way, when I get bored in one area, I can still use my degree, but do something slightly different. But I wanted to do rural social work. So I looked around for a program. By then I had already moved cross country 5 or 6 times. So it wasn't a big deal. And I looked at a bunch of programs to try to figure out what was somewhere near a rural area. Mm-hmm. And I don't think MSWs had quite exploded at that point the way they have. We didn't have a lot of online education. So I actually got my MSW in Portland, Maine at the University of New England. And I did my internships in very rural areas of Maine. And I knew I wanted to do hospice and end of life. My stuff is in really in serious illness, but I didn't want to deal with the snow anymore. So I moved to Washington State to the Kitsap Peninsula, where I met my spouse pretty quickly. And he was like, yeah, cool, I'm not staying. And so I followed him to Michigan for him to get his PhD, all the while actually doing practice and doing hospice. I did some hospital work, home care. So then we moved after his PhD was finished. I was pregnant at the time with my second kiddo. So I was like, I'm going to take a break from working because by the time I finished orientation, right, that takes forever. Like I would then be on maternity leave. And about the time that we had planned on me going back to work, COVID hit. Mm. So I actually started teaching online and I loved it. And I had gotten to the point with clinical practice that I was really kind of burned out, but not because of patient issues, because our medical industrial complex is oriented towards profit and education and research and not patient care. Yeah. And I couldn't be part of that machine anymore. I could not crush people in that machine anymore. So now I've switched to doing a PhD program focused on, and my research is still focused on serious illness. I've gotten more into disability justice. So that's cool. But yeah, but ASWB stuff specifically, I remember during COVID, there was a like racial leadership, I don't remember what they called it, a round table.
Everybody had one of those during COVID.
They had like live on Facebook. And so it had like ASWB,
yeah, I remember that.
NABSW, and Dwight, the CEO of ASWB at the time, like NABSW was pushing on stuff. And somebody asked like, are you guys going to do pass rate analysis? And of course they were still saying like, we don't collect that data. It was just in two different piles and they had to put it together. But part of his answer, and it's still online, because when I heard his answer, I was like, no way they're going to actually leave this online. His answer was like, well, all standardized testing has disparities. So like, we know it's there, whatever. And I was just like, that fundamentally doesn't jive with social work values. I was like, he is saying the quiet part out loud. There's no way they're going to leave this up. And it's still there. It's still there.
And we'll talk about it because it's even in one of the reports that they just recently released. It's still there. But
So that was the start of paying attention to ASWB for me and just being like, what is happening? Yes. That it's just like, all standardized tests. So whatever. Where is our responsibility to fight oppression? To do something within our own discipline. And that was even before the pass rate analysis. I think that was part of the push that ended up making them do it.
Well, I'm going to tell you something. You are the first person that got into the field of social work that I have met that can like count without like fingers or calculator or like do math. Shout out to you. I hope we haven't gotten on your nerves too much because, you know, we are wordy folk over here. We feel and we talk.
You know what's funny though is because now I'm into research, I am much more a qualitative researcher.
I love
like
that.
I do, stats are fine, but like there's not meaning in stats. We derive meaning from numbers, but it feels sometimes distant.
It
I'm
is.
Really much more perhaps doing interviews and focus groups and having conversations with people and being in the messiness of life, which is what I enjoyed, I think, in clinical practice.
I love it.
I have shunned the math.
How have you given up that life?
Not like quantitative research.
I love it. Well, look,
I can follow it. I don't enjoy it.
I'm right there with you. I barely made it out of research class in grad school. I said, what is this foolishness? I will never use the SPSS in my life once I start doing work. But speaking of research and the doctor, Dr. Matt, please, I would absolutely love to hear, because we even have some similarities with like VCU being a part of our journey. I just don't know like at what part in your story that plays a role. So I would love to hear how you found your way into social work.
It's possible. I was there from 2012 to 2016. I don't know if we crossed paths.
I was there.
Abe, did you get like a really really nervous, like very wet behind the ears adjunct professor?
I would have remembered you. I would have remembered you.
Okay, cool. Well, it's wonderful to make the connection now. I went to VCU for my graduate work. That's where I got my PhD. Very thankful to the taxpayers of the Commonwealth of Virginia. If you're considering a PhD, go someplace that will pay you. So the PhD mostly came about out of my postgraduate work. So for the longest time, I wanted to be a therapist and a counselor. And I realized I do not have the character as a human. I can't sit and listen attentively to someone talk about their life for that long. And that's cool. And so, you know, I've done clinical case management. I've done residential care work. I've done intensive treatment work. Most of my like postgraduate work was in either Housing First or project-based dual diagnosis, housing for people with severe mental health issues, as well as substance use disorders. So doing triage in the drug war for a long time will radicalize you. And it's not like I need to further proof along those lines, but like the scale of things and the like thin amount of support that people actually get and the dehumanizing experience that they have inside of the system. I thought I wanted to do policy analysis and then realized that think tanks are probably not the best place to do the kind of research that I wanted to do, because there are very few rich billionaires who agree with me. And so, like, it's just, like, not a convenient amount of, like, things that I wanted to do. So I ended up in academia, which I genuinely love. And so I get to do a lot of research and scholarship and teaching and service, all related to open education and open scholarship and open science. So that's mostly what my work focuses on now.
Yeah. I love it. I love this, the idea. And I love the way that you show up in the spaces that I have been with you in, but then also even online. And I hear now from you just saying, like, your research and scholarship is around open education and open access, the way you just willingly give of information. Like, I don't think folks understand how much power is wielded when information is hoarded. And so, like, when you have research, university partners, or, like, subject matter experts that are willing to give information freely, and I'm talking about good information, it makes your work on the other side in community, grassroots, wherever you are falling in to, like, get this work done, it makes it so much more easier. So, like, shout out to you and all the other folks that operate in that space of, like, being open and willing to, like, give of information. And, like, personally for me, it's been, I've been able to, like, get on Twitter and ask for, like, research articles. Like, hey, y'all, I need this research article. And, like, people will then email me research articles that are locked behind the ivory towers of universities and colleges. So, like, I really appreciate colluding with folks like y'all. And so, in terms of our colluding, now let's talk about the ASWB. Don't hide, Matt. Don't hide it. Because, you know, Jen, you already kind of spoke to it. And I remember, and thank you for helping re-jog the memory. Like, how did all this even get started? It was definitely that Facebook Live. And it was, Angela was on there, who was the former president and CEO of the NASW. I almost called him Daryl. What was that man's name from the ASWB? What's his name?
I think it was Dwight.
His name is Dwight Hymans.
There we go, Dwight. Because he was there for a minute when I was doing my little read. I was like, dang, this man had been over at the ASWB for a month of Sundays. He was on there. And then, yes, they were definitely talking and taking questions from the audience. And they were saying a whole bunch of wild stuff that really just had me thinking, oh, wait, everybody messed up. NASW, the ASWB, CSWE, everybody messed up. The only people in my mind that has been getting this right for a number of decades of an organization that I am aware of has been like the NABSW. Like, they have been on the right side of history since their inception when you think about the profession of social work. So most people got introduced just to the ASWB, so that's the Association of Social Work Boards, and all their challenges with examination in 2022. When they released the pass rate analysis that they told folks for decades, because it was like the national deans of whatever that organization was, like, they have been asking for just analysis, or, like, give us the information and we'll analyze it for you. And they're like, oh no, we don't collect it. We can't give it this, that, and the third, lie after lie after lie after lie. So here comes 2022, and they finally released this report that really set a lot of this movement ablaze. I'm gonna just call it what it is. And has upended what I believe some social workers in this profession have held on to as, like, the absolute truth. Like, if you can pass the examination, this makes you a good social worker. You can protect the public. You can go out and do good work. When we all know all of that is absolutely false. So I would love for y'all to just speak from your own perspectives and experiences from, like, when the report finally hit in 2022, coupled with all the information that y'all have known to be true about just examinations, but the social work examination in general. What did all that information do for you to kind of ignite the energy that you still have to this day to see this movement forward in terms of creating these clinical alternative or just examination alternative pathways for social work?
I can, I mean, I think it really built our movement. So there was a whole bunch of us hanging out on Twitter at the time. And I remember about a year before that, Alex Remy had successfully, she had complained a lot on Twitter about lactation supports during the ASWB exam and that they were treated as disability accommodations. And she had successfully done a change.org petition and they had changed their policies. ASWB had listened and done it. And so I don't know where the idea started. There was a good group of folks already gathered when somebody looped me in, but it was just like, hey, a whole bunch of us are putting together a change.org petition to see about, right, trying to bring together a bunch of folks around the pass rate disparities, to bring about change, to organize, right? Because even though NASW and CSWE and ASWB, they have COIN and they have, right, like organizational power.
Yeah.
If enough of us get together outside of those structures, we can have power, mm-hmm. right? Power of people. And so I think that was really a big place where we all got together and we built that with some, everybody kind of had their different pieces of putting that change.org petition together. Some of us pulling in the research, some of us yeah. making the demands. I think that's really where our movement was kind of born.
Yeah.
Me, I got pulled into like focusing more on the ASWB exams also by social work Twitter. It was a couple of years before that, and it was Gerald Joseph, who now LCSW,
yes,
who was tweeting about was tweeting about their experience mm-hmm. trying to put down their gender on the exam. And then in so doing, like put out a screenshot demonstrating that they very clearly collect the race data that they claimed not to collect. And so that being very definitive evidence that like this was, there was something there and that the data like could be constructed.
Yeah. What pissed y'all off the most about like that data report when it came out in 2022? Because everybody had to get pissed off about something, to be like, what? To like then get activated. So like once you finally read through it, like what pissed y'all off from going through that report?
Matt, you go.
Cool. So I think the fact that it tests no hypotheses is the most annoying thing for me, that there is no attempt to explain what these issues are. And there are a ton of psychometric tests, some of which are required, some of which are just like good to do, that are sitting on the shelf that ASWB just refuses to do. The thing that jumped out at me first, though, was that their infographics were inaccurate. In the report, they talked about like that first time pass rates were the best and provided like the most accurate way to compare across racial, linguistic, and age groups. But all their infographics had these slightly inflated numbers, which are the eventual pass rates, which are like 10 to 15% higher for each group. So, you know, while that doesn't seem like it's very much, it means that like on first glance, the Black pass rate was over 50%,
mm-hmm.
whereas it's not.
Right.
And so like, it's those kind of sneaky things that like, I think jumped out at me just at the beginning, and you sort of know to read for inaccurate and just like really misleading communications inside of the reports.
What about you, Jen?
The sleight of hand was definitely a problem, right? The we don't collect that data when actually you do collect it, you just don't put it together and do this report, right? The fact that like we're doing eventual pass rate but never telling you how many times it takes for people to pass. The fact that for years they had been pushing states to not let people take the clinical exam till after supervision because they do better when then the results with age suggest that's not. But I think the thing that really was the worst was the conclusion on that report, because it was all about, it felt like blaming the victims, right? It was all about stereotype threat and all the reasons why social workers must be doing a bad job. And that's why they can't pass the test. No, right, taking of responsibility at all to say, yeah, we're going to figure out why this is the case and we're going to fix it. Like no responsibility whatsoever. It really echoed what Dwight had said at that conversation, right? Yeah. They did this report and their perspective didn't change. It mm-hmm. was just like, it's not our fault. It's not our problem. And I think one of the things I realized around that time, and it was maybe part of that, maybe something else, is that all of these organizations are involved in social work. They are not social work organizations, right? Ooh. ASWB is a regulatory body that is involved in social work. Mm-hmm. And ASW is a membership organization of social workers. And yes, they employ lots of social workers, but none of these organizations actually abide by social work values. And that was one of the things where I was just like, nope, we're burning it down.
Well, like he literally put out an open letter. The dude put out an open letter that said, like, we are not accountable to social workers. We are accountable to our members. It is legit. I mean, I'm like paraphrasing very like slightly, like that is the, that's the quote, man. Like it's very clear that they don't believe that we are their constituents, and that their decisions would really have any kind of impact on us. I think the thing that like rubbed me the wrongest out of all of it, and it was just the idea that they would do a robust analysis of the pass rate data, which is something they promised to do, they've never done. And like, we literally just don't know what is the psychometric cause of this stuff. Like, there are lots of potential answers. Like, it could be broken in one of the four domain content areas. It could be like a specific topic when it comes up related to the child welfare system, or specific theories, or maybe one specific.
We don't know. And it's also overwhelming when you really think about it. I know for me, what pissed me off the most and continues to make me the most upset is like, it doesn't have to be this way. And it wasn't always this way, right? Like, there was a time in our profession where there was no ASWB, where there were no, where there was no standardized test for social work licensing, where much of that was really left up to these individual states to determine what that looked like for them. When I think about just the history of social work licensing, I know much of it began, honestly, in living rooms with white social workers that primarily worked in the hospital setting that wanted parity with psychologists and psychiatrists and like all these other professions to be able to independently diagnose, but then also just get more money and have the ego stroked. We're being for real, for real. And so California at the time was like one of the first states to really put together an effort to get a standardized test. And that was like in the late 60s when they went about doing that. And then that's when you see like these clinical societies begin to emerge across the country. And once again, like these clinical societies are honestly living room groups of white social workers who are gathering to determine like, how do we best, I don't know, separate ourselves from the others who aren't doing quote unquote clinical work. And I even think about the National Association of Black Social Workers who got wind to this. And they were like, oh, wait a minute. Like, we know for a fact if we continue down this path as a profession of like social work examinations, what that's going to mean for Black people. And if that impacts Black people in the profession at negative rates, it's only going to make it worse for other folks, right, who exist in these other kind of domains of marginalization. And so they were very adamant about saying like, we can't let this happen. Like, social work examinations are going to further separate and divide us. It's going to other us within the profession. It's going to keep people in low paying jobs, push people out of the profession with lived experience and some, and the educational experience. And so now when you see fast forward to 2024, everything that they were talking about in the late 70s and 80s has come to fruition. And you're like, yo, we tried to tell you this decades ago, that if we stay down this road, it's going to continue to get worse. And now, y'all, it is bad. And I don't think folks really understand how dire of a situation this is for our profession, because across the country, we're dealing with a workforce shortage. We're also dealing with a pipeline in the workforce in terms of, this is not becoming an attractive field where folks are seeking get out, then like get into programs and then get into some of these jobs to do whatever social work looks like or means to them. And so we are literally have like, just, you know, the pipeline is are leaving the profession at such high rates, right? And so that is an ongoing challenge. And I have found that one of the reasons, it's not the only reason, but one of the reasons that folks leave this profession is from not being able to pass that examination. I know folks that have tried to take that test about 6 times and have yet to pass it. And it's not the mark of what makes a good social worker. And so when you hear people who are leading these organizations saying like, hey, listen, other examinations and professions have these same challenges, so what? Right? Like, we're just going to go ahead and be just like everybody else. I definitely want to take some time and talk about the recent reports that just came out, that three-part series on looking at the various different areas of just the examination. But I think it was ASWB's attempt at, I guess they call it transparency, was by releasing that three-part series. But even before that, y'all, like, I'm imagining y'all are familiar with the report that Dr. Stacey Hardy Chandler released on July 23rd. It was called Ubuntu in Action, Understanding Pass Rates. Y'all, that pissed me off. I know I stay angry about many things, but I think what really triggered me the most was her inaccurate use of Ubuntu. And so, like, for anybody who's not familiar with Ubuntu, it is an Africa, it's a South African philosophy, and this meaning of like, I am because we are, meaning like, I see you, you see me, we're in life together. I am because we are. And throughout that that piece that she released, it talked about how the profession is moving further away from Ubuntu. But then that makes me go back to what you said, Matt, a little bit earlier. How can it be, I am because you are, I am because we are, when y'all don't even see us as a part of who you are as an institutional organization, right? You don't see us as colleagues. You don't see us as comrades. You don't see us as equals. You don't see us as worthy of being protected. You see us as people who are bound by law to deal with you, truthfully. So like, where is the Ubuntu in any of that? And so she talks about drifting away from Ubuntu and how we need to join hands like children in the village to come together as a profession and collaborate and figure this out. My question for y'all, because y'all have been vocal about this and just involved in your various areas, is when you're kind of watching this issue closely, how have you actually seen the ASWB try to collaborate around just the examination alternatives and, you know, coming together in the spirit of Ubuntu? How have you seen them collaborate? And I'm using air quotations.
I think I have tried to collaborate with the Association of Social Work Boards. So after the release of this report, they put out a request for proposals, which asked people and researchers to associate the exam score disparities with upstream external pipeline factors as early as early childhood experiences were valid and suggested as potential hypotheses. Not part of that RFP was any of the psychometric testing that would be involved, and that would be things like focus groups about the exam, cognitive trials, multiple versions of the exam, so like a measurement equivalency. There wasn't any of that, but I did partner with two social work psychometricians and luminaries inside of the field, one of which, Jerry Bean, is also really into open textbook production. He wrote the Using R, the statistics software for social work, and so our plan was to write it in R and do an open source analysis of the Association of Social Work Boards data to see like what psychometrically were the causes of some of those exam score gaps. We also partnered with Bill Nugent, who wrote the Journal of Society and Social Work Research Journal, the journal article on differential item and differential test functioning, which is essentially the thing that we're trying to do here. We were rejected because we didn't ask for money originally. We literally got a note back that says, you didn't ask for money, so there's nothing further. Mm. And then when we clarified, but we asked for data, it says like, we don't need any money, we just need the data and a computer with R. They clarified that it wasn't clear which data that we wanted to the team. So the RFP was evaluated by ASWB board members, none of which have any kind of psychometric expertise. They also rejected proposals from other researchers to partner with historically Black colleges and universities to even test the kind of upstream pipeline external factors things that they wanted to have in the report. Yeah, it's not great. I have a report coming out, hopefully in Advances in Social Work with Mary Nienow, that sort of describes a little bit more about that process. Mm.
I think the thing that I feel like I am seeing is they sort of are just taking credit for other people's work. Their lobbyists are fighting the stuff about, you know, states trying to get rid of the exam. Their lobbyists are not, in most states, fighting for the compact, but yet they're kind of taking credit for the compact. We had a testimony hearing with the committee that's got our Social Work Modernization Act bills here in Michigan. And one of the committee members asked, like, what are you doing? And they named a handful of stuff, but honestly, the stuff that they're naming, like, yeah, there's the fifth theory stuff that they're trying to doing, which is just exam prep. Right. Yeah. Like, if you're actually got a really good exam that's doing competence, then like all of the exam prep shouldn't make it easier to pass the test because you should be actually doing competence, but all of their research says spending lots of time, like the test prep people exist and have results because you can prep for this test. But the stuff that they listed, it was like, that's stuff that schools are doing, that's stuff that like other folks are doing, the stuff that they are being asked to do, like make it so that if you fail a particular section, you only have to retake that section, right? Like the things that they were being, that they have been asked to do, they're not really doing. They did change so that some items only have three options. I don't think that's actually in the benefit of test takers at all. I think they just threw out whichever distractor was not working well on all of those items because they were like, well, it's not fooling anybody anyway, so let's just get rid of it. Like, I don't think that was actually in the benefit of test takers, right? So there, it's again this like cloak and dagger, sleight of hand stuff. It doesn't feel like they're really collaborating. Go ahead, Matt.
You're not, go for it.
What I was going to say is, I think the opposite is kind of actually true in licensure, right? If you have gotten through your education, you have obtained and maintained employment, right? And in order to do that, right, your clients are probably happy with you. Your coworkers are probably happy with you. Your managers are probably happy with you. Your supervisors are probably happy with you, right? You have gone through all of this community that says that you do a good job, or at least a like minimally competent job, but one test that is not in community with you at all says you don't get whatever licensure level that test is for. Like that, I don't know. To me, I much more trust all the people who actually know you, not what some random multiple choice test, which is so decontextualized from social work practice, says. Right, that's not Ubuntu. All of the rest of it really shows competency from an Ubuntu perspective, right? I am, because we are, right? The people that you are in community with in your social work practice,
They are in community with themselves, which is sort of how they get to the position that they're in right now. So they contract with themselves, they create their own exam, they're the purchaser of that exam. And in this RFP that we were talking about, they not only were the people who were judging the RFP, they also won the RFPs. So all three candidates who won the RFP were previously associated or currently associated with ASWB.
Oh, what do you mean? Like the people who went, like the what, Dr. Joy Kim and Michael Zhu?
So Dr. Joy Kim and Michael Zhu were the previous winners of ASWB's grant funding, getting over six figures to produce three like research reports, one of which is a lit review. She also lobbies on behalf of ASWB based on her experience, and her testimony was part of one of, or at least was submitted in the Maine's unsuccessful effort to get rid of some of the exams in the last legislative session.
Oh, you're blowing my mind. Hold on. Now
so
you blew my little world
the
up, man.
Other one, which I actually participated in, so they got this team from Western Kentucky University to basically like ask social workers in focus groups at different academic conferences, like, what's the deal with this stuff? Like, is it the educator's fault? Should we be doing, and like, there were no questions about the exam itself. There were just questions about like, what could it, you know, educators be doing better? And there was one question about, should it alternative pathways be there? So that team had an external consultant that was only listed on the university blog websites. That was a former 20-year director of ASWB and one of the former members of the committee that provided the grant. So that's not great. And so Joy Kim is the last team. And so those first two teams, one of the teams was supposed to basically like turn the knob, see the change in professional licensure. It was supposed to sort of use Utah data. We haven't seen what they've done yet. The other team from West Kentucky hasn't published yet either, but Joy Kim and her team from Rutgers has. And so they made a lot of sort of grand foopraw, and you don't really need to focus on anything other than the last part of report three. And so, you know, Joy Kim is a fantastic researcher. I don't always agree with what she writes, but she is usually reporting things in a way that is relevant to the scientific record.
Yeah. Well, let's get into these reports then. For anybody who's not familiar with them, on August 15th, the ASWB released these three reports by Dr. Joy Kim and her team at Rutgers School of Social Work. And the three reports focused on, the first one was around the profile of social work license examinees. The second one was the determinant of license exams and outcomes. And the third one was the effects of race, ethnicity on clinical exam outcomes. And so even like you just, you know, you slightly said it, but I agree with you. And some of those other two reports were like, all right, bro, like we get it. Like, especially the second one for me, the one around like determinants of license exam outcomes, it really was like, look at all these other professions and their exams compared to our exam. And we're not any different than them. So why are you asking us to change? Like that was pretty much the gist of the second report for me. The first report just really regurgitated things that we're just validating for a person that exists in a Black body that has taken this license exam and passed it, but also has dealt with, and no, I'm in community with a lot of other Black and brown people who have not had the same experience as me, just to see how many, it's like Black people in the South specifically where I reside struggle to pass the exam. Right. I was like, this is incredibly telling. And there are not enough people being loud about this particular thing. On top of that, the first one really highlighted how Black folks take the exam later on in life at older ages and have way more experience prior to taking the exam when compared to white counterparts that take the exam and pass. Right. So you got Black folks coming into the field, getting their MSWs later, taking these exams later, coming with more experience in comparison to white counterparts who are younger in the field, less experience passing the test. And so those things really stood out for me in those particular reports. Matt, your head is shaking. So I want you to be able to like let it rip when you think about this three-part series. And now that you're telling me the lies and the deception, well, it's even hard to take it at face value from the ASWB because of some of the methods of going about securing the team to then produce what might just be considered propaganda.
Well, and hold on, before Matt starts, like they were asking specifically for people to look at upstream factors.
Were they? So they were
this, this RFP was not like whatever research you want to do. No, it was from curated. The beginning, it was pulling the same stuff from the conclusion of the pass rate data, which is it happens before our test. It's not our fault.
Yeah, it's not our fault. Yeah.
Actually, worse than that, it's not from the conclusion. It's not just from there. It is from the examination guidebook. So prior to the release of that 2022 report, said for the longest time that the ASWB exams, quote, are statistically free of race and gender bias.
Wow.
And then July, before that August report, guess what it got changed to surreptitiously overnight? It's now a guidebook, by the way. It's not a handbook. And it says that only external factors are responsible for past score disparities. We acknowledge that there are past score disparities, but only external factors. And so this RFP was, at least in my opinion, a way to try and manufacture that empirical record. And so with that as the context, it should be just glaring how little like that empirical hypothesis has actually borne any fruit. So as I mentioned before, the like exam pass rate data report didn't test any hypotheses. It's just a descriptive analysis, percentage, compare them with your eyes. This data report uses our odds ratios and regression to do a multivariate analysis where you can actually see how much more likely are Asian, Black, and Latina social workers to fail the exam. Mm-hmm. And according to this model, just based on the facts that Asian examinees were 2.055 times higher than the odds for white examinees. The odds of exam failure were 6.483 times higher for Black examinees and 2.771 times higher for Latina examinees. And so their big conclusion and what they're trumpeting and what the Ubuntu and the big we need to come together about is when you come in with all of those individual factors, they take it later and employment isn't as good and they have like they go to online programs and all that good stuff, then the pass score disparity goes down to just between 1.87 and 5.1%, depending on the ethnicity. So it goes down like a little bit, but it's still people who like, and what does that actually demonstrate? It demonstrates that if social workers gained the ability to magically control all pipeline and workforce factors, we would still be at a place where our examination at the clinical level, Black test takers are five times less likely or five times more likely to fail. And so it doesn't make a lot of sense. The other thing that doesn't make any sense about this is that in 2018, all pass scores went down. So
in, was that around the time when the exam changed? Wasn't there like a revision?
Yeah. So, and they literally say in their report, it's because of the exam blueprint change.
Yeah.
Like if you read the report, it says like the bachelor's and the master's exam scores went down about 10% from like close to 80% to like close to 70% for all test takers because of this new exam blueprint introduction, which used a different set of practice tests, but also importantly used a different measure of reliability, one that didn't use multivariate approach or didn't use item response theory and instead used a lot older technology with classical test theory. And so when these new exams were introduced in 2018, I guess these external factors just knew and they got so much worse in 2018. I don't know how it happened. And for some reason, it's just the white test takers who are still hanging out right above that norm and just the Black and Latina and Indigenous test takers where you can see it's going down. The last thing that I'll say is that the exam pass rate analysis doesn't contain data from before 2018. It only contains stuff for the last 4 years, which, I mean, there's no real way that this didn't impact minoritized test takers more. Because if the pass score for white test takers is above the norm now and is about where the pass score or pass rate was before, all of these like negatives have accrued to minoritized test takers, and there just isn't an explanation that fits into that external factors thing that actually matches that. And more importantly, there is no internal investigation as to like why that's happening and how we can fix it in the next round of exams
or any motivation to fix it. Like, I don't think they have any motivation to fix it. I don't know, like, people, and y'all may have found this throughout just, you know, the last couple of years of this just publicly, how many social workers don't understand how this works, like how our field is regulated and how it's determined at each state, and each state goes into agreement with the ASWB. They are not mandated yet. For many states, it's written into their code, but that's because they went and advocated, lobbied, whatever, and got ASWB written into the law. So then they have to work with the ASWB for examination, but there's still option and choice. And I don't think people understand, like, the regulatory boards and the ASWB, they're like siblings. And so when you think like your board has really got your back, no, they really rock with the ASWB heavy. ASWB pays for them to come to a conference in DC or New Orleans, and they have a phenomenal time every year. Like, they got them in their pocket.
That is what ASWB is, right? It is a membership organization of state regulatory boards.
That's what it is.
But it's interesting in some of this advocacy efforts, right? We will push at like state boards in different states to ask certain questions, and they'll be like, well, ASWB will answer that. And when you start asking ASWB, they're like, no, that's the state board's problem. And it's just like, it probably is the state boards, and maybe they just don't realize it. There's a couple other things ASWB does. Yes, they own the exam and they administer it. They develop it, own it, and administer it, which makes them a lot of money, which might be why they don't want to change. They also are one of the only organizations that can approve national level CEUs. Right. So for the larger conferences, they are often the ones that approve the CEUs people need. And they're one of the only ones that you can do nationally. Otherwise, you have to kind of do piecemeal, and it becomes very expensive.
Very difficult.
But I also will say ASWB isn't without power in a certain way. So a number of states for a while were letting people take the clinical exam anytime after they graduated with their MSW, especially if they didn't have a master's exam. And ASWB pushed really hard on states to make them not allow people to take the exam until after their 2 years of supervision. Like, lawyers involved, we will stop letting you use the exam if you do not change. Now, like, they have the Practice Act, which is, of course, has testing at every single level. But the idea behind the Practice Act, what they talk about is like trying to move states into consistent practice to help support interstate practice, right? If we get everybody a little bit more in line, then reciprocity is either easier, and then we can build it easier, which then it's funny because it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Because now we're working on a compact, and the compact people are like, look, we don't care what it is. We just do what most states are doing. We just look at the common practice, and that's what goes in the interstate compact. And of course, what's the common practice? The thing that ASWB has been pushing us towards for years.
Yeah.
Which has the exam at every level.
Every level. I would love to be able to just like sit and talk with somebody in California from like before 2018, it might have been. They were the last state to hold off on letting the ASWB come. And I want to know why. Like, they were the last ones that were like, no, we have our own law and ethics. We have our own internal examination for the state. We're not going to use your exam. But something happened. I would love to know just like what happened. Like, there's a key there. But we have alluded a little bit to a lot of the energy that has been put behind some legislative action that is occurring across the country. And I definitely want to make some time to talk about that, because there have been some successes. There also have been some like, damn, well, that didn't work out. So now let's get ready to do this again. So if y'all could just kind of speak to what is happening nationally, even locally, if you're aware of some things where you are and where you practice, to really look at creating these just exam alternative pathways.
I mean, I think Matt can speak to California too, if you want to.
Yeah, you know why? You got the tea?
I do not have the tea. I have a policy history related to the exam use policy, but I think Jen sort of talked about that. I don't know the exact timing of that, but like, I would also point out that like, you live in Virginia, like y'all didn't have the MSW exam until like a minute ago.
They sure didn't. So, and like, they tried to make it a requirement, and we said, you will not do that.
So here is what I would say is like, we're going to talk about all of that stuff, but like, I would really encourage you to look at your own laws and then look at, but not you, but like your listeners to look at the laws in your state, and then also look at the laws in your neighboring states. I live in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania follows the Model Practice Act. We're right next to Jersey. Jersey licenses BSWs, doesn't use the exam. And there are 10 states that do that. And many states now are licensing people and not using the MSW exam. So Virginia used to be one. There are a couple of other states that have removed it right after the 2022 pass rate analysis. So Massachusetts was one of them. Utah was actually one of them as well. So it's not just like a red blue state kind of thing. So there's that action. And then there is the alternative pathways at the clinical level. And so the alternative pathways at the clinical level, probably the best known one is Illinois, because NASW Illinois makes a lot of noise and they're fantastic. And so the pathway that they did was groundbreaking, and it was for all social workers. It wasn't the first alternative pathway to clinical licensure inside of social work's policy history. There have been many others. We talked about California's. Texas has had an alternative one for a long time. It got rid of it in the early 2000s. Like, so there are a lot of alternatives. Illinois is basically, instead of once you fail the exam, you got to take another 3,000 hours of supervision, which, since this was a multi-year legislative process, many of the gate-kept social workers had been doing already. And since there was that grandfather clause, all those people were able to get licensed like right as the law came into effect, which really like helped ease those workforce challenges. The policy history in Minnesota is even better, because you went to the same school the same time I did. Did you have to read The Spirit Catches You When You Fall Down, the story of a Hmong girl, her of American doctors, the inclusion of two cultures?
Yep.
By Anne Fadiman. Yeah, we all did. And the community that talks about, they had to create an alternative pathway to clinical licensure to service the Hmong community in Minnesota. And so if you look at Skeen and Goodenough's like article where they talk about it in The Field Educator, it really came out of like, this community doesn't test well. And so they had this alternative pathway on the books for a long time, where you had to be foreign born, you had to have English as your second language. And so they got rid of that. And so now that pathway is open to anybody, and you do not have to fail the exam in order to do that. You just have to, again, collect additional supervision. I don't know the number of hours off the top of my head, unfortunately, but I would assume it's pretty similar to Illinois.
I think it's Illinois is like 3,000.
Illinois is 3,000, so I'm assuming it's similar to that.
Which equates to 2 years for people who may not know how to add that up.
Oh my God. So like one of the best things about this was connecting with Dr. Ben Kaltman out in California, who tracked down the original source of why is it 3,000 hours anyway?
Why is it three?
Like he literally tracked down the like original citation from like this was just like the best idea that people had in like 1920s, 1930s era psychiatric training. And like that's one guy we're was still like using and they're norms and like I understand why, but like I think like getting to some of the original sins of the mental health profession.
Wait, someone flipped a coin, you said?
No, this was just based on the norms of like what inside of
the norms at the time.
Inside of Vienna where they're training.
And yeah, we have the quote in the paper we wrote where like they used to just do constant supervision and this one guy is just like, I am tired of listening to the other psychiatrists on end. Like after 2 years they can just go into their practice is basically what it was. Like, I'm tired of listening to them and supervision.
Yeah. And you know, there's so much space for social work regulatory boards to determine what it looks like at their particular levels. Because I even think about me here in Virginia. Yeah, Matt, you alluded to now we have the LBSW exam and the LMSW exam. 2 years ago, they were trying to make the LMSW a requirement to then begin your clinical supervision hours to then gain your LCSW. And the way they're able to make some of these rules happen through like these petitions of lawmaking, which just go directly to the board because the board has a lot of executive power to then determine what they do and what they will not do. And I think when you kind of understand how much power they really have, and those who understand how that power works and the systems work, they're able to get these things done. Even like some of these changes with clinical supervision, for you to become a clinical supervisor, you used to have to be like post 3 years licensure. And then you can start supervising folks. And now it's just like two. And then you're like, well, what was the science behind that? What was the decision making behind that? Well, we just need more supervisors to supervise social workies. Well, hell, we need more social workers. So why can't we figure out like how to change it so that we can get more in the profession? I don't get it.
So like one of my favorite things is so Kim, the scholar who authored that report that we're talking about, she was the last person who gave the keynote address at ASWB's education meeting. She sort of talks about this huge literature review that she did, like over 400 articles, like on social work, other professions. It's a lot of what you sort of wrote. And she said, so the only article that she found that links taking an exam to public protection is this dissertation from 1995 that surveyed Kansas behavioral or social work board records, which like is its own kind of messed up, which by the way, did not measure race. Putting all of that aside, reading that dissertation, which is very well done, talks about a history in which the examination for some people at that time was a literal examination of documents. Oh, you're required to take the exam now? Oh, it's 1982. That exam requirement just started. I don't believe in the exam, so I'm just going to make sure that these documents are correct. And now you're all... So, like, literally, she had a thing of people who were accepted or legacied from those examination requirements, and then, like, a separate group of people who were untested, because those are not the same group. And so... there was also a policy history in which like the passing score was reduced down to 57 1 year because there were so few social workers that passed and there was a workforce crisis. And so you see is that like those are not one-time exceptions, is that those are exceptions that people keep making for themselves over time. Mm-hmm. And that where I really like what Illinois and Minnesota are doing is that those are exceptions and grandfathering clauses that or grandparenting clauses that like will carry throughout time.
Yeah.
And I know Illinois, before all this started, got rid of the exam at the bachelor's and master's level because ASWB was like, you're not using it the way we want you to, so you should reorganize your licensure tiers. And Illinois was like, or we could just not use your exam. Fine with us. And so they have the alternative, the clinical, whereas Minnesota, right, they put this alternative at every level of licensure because they do use the exam at their bachelor's level, for example, and you can do the alternative at the bachelor's level. I looked it up, it's additional 2,000 hours of supervision. And so that's the other thing that's really cool is I think about Minnesota is they took sort of a limited thing and they were like, yeah, let's just open it up, not just at the clinical level, but all of these levels. It doesn't matter what level, it doesn't matter who to do this alternative.
Yeah, because they're so necessary at this point. And just to hear all the discourse and all the social workers who can't see beyond, but then also are trapped within like their own cycles of oppression and foolishness of wanting to protect an exam that doesn't give a damn about them or any of us. It's like mind blowing to me. And so when I don't want to get into the licensure compact, that's a conversation for a different day. It also is just like, okay, y'all, whatever. But I do just want to be able to give voice to something that maybe might be able to offer some clarity to people who are saying like, we need the exam because what about the compact? I want to be able to practice in this state and that state and this and the third. Well, the licensure compact has a whole set of issues that we don't even know about yet, y'all. It's about to get bad. It looked cute on paper, but it's about to get real bad. But I do just want to note to people, when we're talking about licensure alternatives and different pathways to getting a licensure that does not require the examination, yes, an exam is written into the compact. What's going to be required is that the boards are going to have to do good information. Like people who potentially want a compact license, which will be a whole separate license, will have to follow those rules to get one. People who simply want to practice in their community, in their state, just get to go take the alternative pathway and get like, just because you don't need, you know, one or the other doesn't cancel them out. Like you can go that way. If you know you want a compact license, cool. Go the route of getting the exam and taking it and this, that, and the third and passing it. If you know you just want to simply practice in your community and a pathway is presented to you that does not require an examination, you should be able to have that option. And so just really want people to listen and hear, yeah, abolish the exam through and through. And I'm not a fool. I understand like there's a lot of money and politics wrapped up in it. And so we just want options, y'all. Like give people options.
Yeah, because I mean, most states don't necessarily have, right, licensure by reciprocity or licensure by endorsement. Some do, but there's plenty that don't. And nobody's raising the concerns about all those legacy social workers who haven't passed the exam being able to move around, right? Like the other thing that I think has come up in our state a little bit, right, about the numbers, about the workforce shortage and how, right, after Illinois, we had a lot more social workers join the field. Some of the folks in our state are like, yeah, but we need quality, not quantity. And I think the thing that most people don't realize, right, is that when we do these alternatives, it is not just like a free-for-all, right? The people who are using the alternatives have been in practice for a while. One of the problems we have in Michigan is that we have a limited license structure. That means that you can only renew your master's level license a certain number of times until you have to get the clinical license. Wow. And in order to get that clinical license, you have to pass that test. So we have people who have been in the discipline for 10 years who either have to leave the state or leave our field.
Wow.
Right. And you cannot tell me, right, from a Ubuntu perspective, they have worked sometimes like in the same school district for all those 10 years. You cannot tell me that they are not competent.
Yeah.
Right. Those are quality people who have been having supervision or engaged in good practice, obtaining and maintaining employment for all of the years that they have not been able to pass that exam. These are quality social workers that we need to keep in our profession, mm-hmm. that are being driven out of the profession, mm-hmm. by an exam that is not, I think, a good measure of competency. What is social work competency anyway?
There isn't. I wish they would just say law and ethics. Like, if you want me to be able to pass an exam and understand the laws and ethics of my, you know, locality or my state where I practice, then give me a test on law and ethics and leave me alone.
And that makes a lot more sense in interstate practice too, right? If we have a national exam where everybody has to learn and know all the federal level stuff and then like your little state thing, like let's make sure we know all of the state rules where you're going to be practicing, because those are the rules we're beholden to. Those are the rules that are going to get us in front of the disciplinary, you know, committee of our state boards and get addressed.
It's worse because the compact actually gets rid of jurisprudence exams. So if you have a compact license, and for example, if you're a state like Texas that has a jurisprudence exam, or what?
Vermont.
Oh yeah, in Vermont that has a jurisprudence exam. Interstate compact license holders are exempted from those jurisprudence exams, which means those people who have been in practice for a long time don't need to learn the laws of that state before they practice in those states. Given the like context in which we are occurring, jurisprudence exam would give boards probably some more affirmative protection, because it's not like, I mean, the board of social work and like the social workers in states where there are really oppressive regulations and stuff like that are trying their best to try and cope with that and are, yeah, it's not great. The other thing
bad.
That I would say, like for the people who are pushed out of the profession, it's not, it, there are a lot of states that do that, that like give you a time limit on sort of the pipeway or pipeline licensure statuses. So like those people will either drop out into paraprofessional roles, which are not supervised by a social work board, decreasing public safety, or you will be replacing that labor with compact labor from out of the state, which is not good from a workforce development perspective. I'm assuming you would like to grow your own social workers who will live in your communities and be inside of your state for a long time rather than somebody who is splitting their time across a lot of states, which is not a bad thing. But like, I'm assuming from the state perspective, the compact labor is going to ease some things, but you would really want to develop your own social workers, especially ones that have been there for a long time.
You would think so. And I think for me, the compact, it really just, it, for me, it's just like, all I think about is like private practice clinicians. Like that's really what the compact, that's who it's for. Everybody else, when you are doing social work, clinical or otherwise, you're actually in community at a local community service board, in a mental health agency, at a nonprofit org, working in a legislator that's, you know, specific to a state or a locality. You're not sitting at a computer being able to tap in and out and service people across the country doing individual therapy.
And the like lean towards clinical practice has been a story of licensure from the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. The people that from the beginning were like, is this really what we want to do? Part of the argument was like, this is really skewed towards clinical practice, and social work is so much more than
more
clinical
than
practice. And that still exists.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've talked a lot about serious things like social work examinations, but I wouldn't be me if I didn't end with my two favorite questions. The first one that I have to ask y'all is like, what does hood rat stuff look like to you? Meaning we do a whole bunch of things, right? In this work, in this field, Matt, you're teaching, Jen, you're raising tiny humans in a PhD program, also still engaged in the work. But when you think about like how you reclaim a bit of your time and do things that bring you joy for self, what do hood rat activities look like to y'all? What y'all be doing for fun? Or joy or rest?
Sure. Yeah. I am a burner. I don't know if you've heard of Burning Man or any of those scenes.
Wait, you be out in the desert?
Not this year. No, I have tiny kids and not very much spending
money. You have been out in the desert. Like, have you been to the one where like they were raining?
Yeah, like
and they
four times.
Get out?
The regional ones are really where it's at. There's a ton of good ones in Virginia. I can hook you up, man. There's one
absolutely
like
not
too. But yeah, the regional
not
ones are really
that
fun.
about
So,
you.
yeah. I mean, my students know that about me. But yeah, those are the places where I get to do fun performance arty kind of things and get to go be a nonsense person and
I
go do
love
improv.
It.
You know, way to live.
You do improv, you said?
Yeah, it's basically like an entire festival that's dedicated to yes anding whatever the heck it is that you have going on at the moment.
I love
that sounds
it.
Really cool.
I love
not,
it.
Not necessarily for me. My hood rat stuff is gardening. We've rented for so many years, and we finally bought a house when we when I started my PhD program. And so, like, I've always taken care of whatever plants came with the rented space, but because this was like ours, and not from an ownership perspective, more from like a care and stewardship perspective. But like, we have a lot of water problems on our property, so I have over the years like developed multiple gardens, and I've gotten into native plants. And I don't think I've ever paid attention as much to the change in seasons, how much rain we are getting. Like, having picked up gardening and doing like stewarded of my little piece of the world has gotten me so much more in tune with like the planet that we are living on as a living, breathing entity. So yeah, that's where I sort of reclaim against all of capitalism and the brokenness of the world. I just get my hands in the dirt.
Yes. I love putting my hands in the dirt for hood rat stuff too. Not so much dirt where I'm out at Burning Man. I watched me a little documentary about that. I said, these people are interesting. They were so happy to be muddy and stuck in the mud. It had rained and it was like in Arizona. It was a Burning Man in Arizona. It was like a downpour and they couldn't get out. I said, this is an interesting crop of people. My last question for y'all, and I love to ask this question to folks because anybody who knows me understands I'm on a mission to get out of social work practicing it this way. I'm not doing it forever. So I love to help people be able, you know, dream and imagine their life beyond the field. And so for y'all, when you think about like when it's all said and done and, you know, your time is up and you're ready to go do Burning Man forever, right? Or you just want to go ahead and open up a community garden and don't deal with none of the testing stuff or working in hospice or anything, like what type of legacy are y'all hoping to leave behind in the field of social work?
I am hoping to leave a lot more open of a place than what I found. I found a place that had a lot of really important social justice and mission work that was bound up behind very close practices, very close norms, and I hope that I leave a profession that is far easier to get information and do the kind of work you need to do.
Mm. What about you, Jen?
Yeah, probably about equity. I mean, I'm not in the policy world. I'm also advocating for better access to billing codes, right? Social work is limited to diagnosis and treatment because of how it's defined in the Social Security Act. But we can do so much more. So I really hope we can get to a place where social work is more integrated in medicine, because I think our perspectives are so important in that space. I don't know if we will ever make it less capitalistic, but I think our skills are so important in that space. And again, like my stuff's about serious illness. My stuff's about all the bad things that happen to people, not for any fault of their own, right? There's always tragedies. There's always illness. There's always, they all have to die at some point.
Yeah.
And that space being more easy to navigate, more people supporting folks on those journeys, which unfortunately has to get through the financial part.
Because, well, capitalism, dying is expensive. Yeah. How could the people, if you would like for them to just tap in or get connected, if they want to be able to access information or have questions around the examination, any of the brilliance that y'all have to share, how would y'all want people to get in contact with you if you do want them to get in contact with you?
I'm okay with emails. I can give one to you so you can put it in the show notes.
I will make sure to do that.
There is also an email for Stop ASWB, our network. So if people want to get plugged in to write our grassroots effort, because we are not structured. We are a bunch of folks hanging out, trying to compare notes, share resources, be like, hey, did you hear this news? Did you hear this crap, this testimony? Oh, we got to pay attention to another state. So we do have an email at stopaswb@gmail.com. So that's stopaswb@gmail.com. So we have a space set up for us to kind of network online. And so if you email stopaswb, we can plug folks in that way.
Matt DiCarlo is a professor. I'm on Gmail. I'm also on Blue Sky because I left Twitter. I'm glad that we've been dead naming Twitter this entire time. Absolutely not. I'm on Blue Sky more often than not. Also on Instagram at DiCarlo.Matt.
Yeah, I'm more on Instagram too.
And I will make sure to drop that information to folks in the show notes. What you thought about something?
One other thing.
What?
Yeah. Go ahead. I also have a website, which is opensocialwork.org. On that website, you can find every open textbook and open access book that I know that is relevant to social work organized by class.
So say it one more time. Open what?
Opensocialwork.org. So it is a library of open textbooks and open access books in social work.
Did you have class with Joe Walsh?
I did not have class with Joe Walsh.
Oh, I'm only asking because he was one of the first professors that I remember having that was like, look, don't buy no books, don't do none of that. Here they are. Like, he would give us PDFs.
That's nice because he publishes a lot of books.
And it would be his, and they would make us use his books in class. He would be like, here they are.
Okay.
Matt also sometimes publishes some stuff about ASWB. You have a blog on your website, don't you?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. So there's some of the stuff that we've talked about here, like breaking down some of the numbers. There's a whole bunch of different analyses that he has got on his website that are awesome.
I would say for anybody who wants to educate themselves on this issue and move beyond just your feelings and into facts, please check out Matt's work. Like, it's a wealth of knowledge. And even like the article that y'all worked on together, like there's so much information out there, but you don't have to just let your feelings guide you. Like, you can get good information about why it is important to have these exam alternatives and that the ASWB is just not the end all be all. Y'all, I am so grateful that you decided to share your wisdom and your brilliance with me. Matt, you have blown my mind about this three-part series and these people being in bed with the ASWB, but I'm also not shocked or surprised. But now I got to reframe my whole thinking. My whole thinking behind these reports. I am grateful for y'all. I'm grateful to be in community with y'all, truly. Thank you for your time and thank you for your wisdom.
Hey, we appreciate you too.
Thank you so much for your kind words and for everything that you do on this topic and so many others. Thank you for hosting this podcast. It's such a great resource.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that.